This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Pope Francis had a meeting with the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. Is this just an attempt at religious reconciliation, or is there something more going on here? We're going to talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about how Vladimir Putin is right in the mix and how this gives some concerning insight into relations between Russia and Europe. There's a lot of debate lately about the role of the Constitution in America today, some high-profile criticism of America's founding document, like it shouldn't be used in modern America. Well, I'm going to share with you an extreme expression of that view. It's an article that shocked me to read it, and it shows just how virulent and dangerous some of the criticism against the Constitution really is. Why are we so fat? In the United States, about 2 in 3 people are overweight, and about half of those are obese. This is a serious health issue. Obesity can create a lot of health problems. It's actually one of the leading causes of preventable death. And we're going to talk with nutritionist Jorg Mardian about some of the causes of this epidemic. And we'll conclude with a few words about what happens when you turn a bunch of fifth graders loose on a playground with no supervision. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. On February 12th, Pope Francis met with Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. This is the first time that the leaders of these two churches have met since the Great Schism 1,000 years ago. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer wrote an article about this. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
We're talking with Richard, who's in our office in the UK via Skype. This is more than just a couple of religious leaders who are trying to get along. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Kirill's past and the position that he has in Russia today?
Right. So the Russian Orthodox Church is very, very closely integrated into the Russian government. I mean, it is essentially a tool of the Russian state. Patriarch Kirill has been, there's a whole bunch of allegations around him that he was a former KGB agent. I believe there are some things that are supposed to be X-Files from the KGB that show him on their payroll. And not just him either. I think it's a fairly well-established fact, even if there are some questions about Kirill himself, it's a well-established fact that his whole generation of leaders within the Orthodox Church were very strongly infiltrated by the KGB. So, and then since then, Vladimir Putin has just really made a lot of use of the Russian Orthodox Church to kind of rally people around his vision of Russia. You see this a lot in his speeches. Jeremiah Jacques has really written quite a few great articles on the website, just documenting and detailing how he's used the Russian Orthodox Church to bolster his power. But this is a tool of the Russian government. So when you have Patriarch Kirill meeting with the Pope, you know, that raises a lot of very interesting questions because, as many of our longtime listeners will be aware, we've talked about how the Vatican is going to try and unite all of its daughter churches. But we've also said, well, that might not be the case with the Russian Orthodox Church because of how political it is and how closely associated it is with the Russian government. So with these two meeting, that raised a lot of very interesting questions.
So there is this political dimension to this meeting that we should be aware of. And when Pope Francis came into power, there were a lot of people in Europe, a lot of people in Eastern Europe, and especially Ukraine, who thought, wow, this is great. This man is actually going to be a boost to this pro-West, pro-European position within Ukraine. But that isn't what happened. What has this Pope actually done?
Right. So when the Ukraine the Ukraine crisis flared up in the autumn of 2013, a lot of people did think that he would come out very much against Russia. He himself, I think he had a mentor that was a Ukrainian Catholic. But then also, Ukraine is about 15% Catholic, or it's a little complicated. There are a couple of different churches, one of which is an Orthodox church that is in full communion with the Catholic Church. So 15% that are basically Catholic, and those 15% are just about all pro-Western. And so it made a lot of sense that the Catholic Church would be pro-Western and would be this great pro-Western champion. And even we've got there was the Los Angeles Times at the time. I remember making a note of it, wrote this article raising the question, is the Pope going to be a big champion for the pro-Western movement in Ukraine? Is he going to really give it a boost by coming out in vocal support for it? Instead, he's taken, if anything, the Russian side. So you write as everything, all of these momentous events were going on in November 2013, and you had these big conferences and Ukraine making this sudden reversal in policy where it was going to go pro-West and then it switched to Russia. Right within the very week that all of this was going on, Vladimir Putin had his first ever meeting with Pope Francis. We didn't hear a lot about it. We still don't know what they talked about. But the timing is very interesting. And then what went on afterwards is very interesting, just the way that the Vatican has now been so pro-Russian. Just a couple of articles that noted this, for example, Italy's L'Espresso magazine wrote, Francis has always done all he could not to annoy the Patriarchate of Moscow and the imperial politics of Vladimir Putin, even at the cost of sowing the strongest disappointment among bishops, clergy, and faithful of the Catholic Church in the region. And then the Foreign Affairs magazine, they wrote, one relationship Francis has patiently cultivated is with Putin. So back in 2013, we didn't know what they talked about, but two or three years down the line, it's very clear that he's taken Putin's side. And just to even add to this, Patriarch Kirill, he publicly thanked, he said, I would like to note with satisfaction that the Holy See, as he called it, the Vatican itself, has always pursued what he called a balanced stance towards the situation in Ukraine, which basically means taking Russia's side.
So a lot to talk about here, because we've made drawn a lot of attention to the fact that Russia's aggression and that Putin's adventurism has put a lot of European leaders, made a lot of European leaders nervous, obviously in Eastern Europe, but really throughout Europe, and that this is going to be a major unifying factor within Europe. You also have, we were talking on the program a couple of weeks ago, some high-profile German politicians who are visiting Moscow and meeting with Putin, and the whole relationship, particularly between Germany and Russia, has some very important overtones to them for a lot of reasons. We'll talk about some of those reasons. But here the Pope is kind of in the middle of the fray here. He's taking the same side as Vladimir Putin in some pretty high-profile issues here. And some people have gone so far as to say that Putin is influencing the Pope. What do we make of just the Pope's position, given the fact that there are so many people who are concerned about the threat that Putin poses?
Right. So we don't know for sure exactly why the Pope has taken the stance that he has. I mean, it could possibly be because he is trying to bring the Orthodox Church in line and back and in union with Rome. And he thinks by making these concessions to Putin and to the Russian Orthodox Church, it will bring them around. However, to make all of these major concessions, and really, he's making a lot of the Catholics in Ukraine very angry with the Vatican and with the Catholic hierarchy over in Rome. So to make these big concessions with nothing in return except for maybe a vague hope for unity in the future, that seems a little naive, and you don't usually get that kind of naivety from the Vatican. They're usually pretty savvy, and you'd have thought they wouldn't be making those kind of mistakes when dealing with a dictator like Putin. So I think it's very likely there's something much more to it than that. So what we talk about in this article is we have been expecting some kind of a deal between Europe and the Vatican. And Mr. Ron Fraser put a lot of this very well. And so we quoted some of the things that he wrote up on that several years ago. But there are just so many intersecting interests now between Europe and and Russia. And you just see them multiplying all the time. We've often talked about fuel. You've just got that common border along Eastern Europe. Where do you draw the line between Russia and Europe? And that's created a lot of friction and the expansion of NATO into the West. Just recently, though, you've got Syria. We've also talked on this program, for example, about how Russia could make life very difficult for Europe within Greece and Cyprus. and some of those key pieces of strategic real estate. There's so many intersecting interests that really, if Europe and Russia are going to start to get a handle on other things and not just focus on fighting each other the whole time, they are going to have to come to an agreement. They are going to have to come to a deal. This is something that you see time and time again throughout history. If the two of them really, if either one wants to be able to focus elsewhere, it needs to be able to have a deal, make sure the other one's not going to stab it in the back. And so we would expect Europe to come to this kind of agreement. And so could the Vatican play a role in doing this? And I think that's something that's very plausible. For example, one journalist wrote, the Kremlin sees, I think this was in the Daily Beast, the Kremlin sees the Vatican as a multidimensional power, bigger in some ways than what Russia considers the West. This is one reason why Putin has met twice with Pope Francis in the recent years to discuss the importance of the changing political climate. So could it be that the Vatican and Russia are working on having some kind of arrangement between these two powers so that Europe and Russia can both focus elsewhere in the world?
So it has an appearance, certainly, of being a religious reconciliation, but it's just impossible to ignore the political implications of what's happening here.
Absolutely. I think you said, like we said right at the start, the patriarchy, the Russian Orthodox Church is just very obviously and overtly a political institution. And then even the Catholic Church. I mean, we've seen a huge amount. I mean, just look at the Cuba deal. And the Catholic Church is very open and upfront now about how they played a very political role there. You had I think it was a Catholic archbishop or cardinal, go and see Mr. Obama and bring a letter from the Pope and get all of this rolling. So, yeah, there's plenty of evidence that the Catholic Church even admits it plays a very public diplomatic role, and especially if it comes to mediating between different sides in a conflict or bringing nations together. You know, that's something that it does fairly often.
So the moves that Putin is making to influence European politics and to plant his flag in Eastern Europe, it seems like, say, these relationships that he's trying to foster and this, the fact that Patriarch Kirill, that he would have visited the Pope, they would have had this meeting definitely at the Kremlin's request, that he's behind this. It's almost like he's using this as another front to kind of strengthen his position with respect to Europe.
Yes, I think that there are even some, I think it was the Daily Beast citing anonymous sources saying that Patriarch Kirill didn't actually even want to meet with the Pope and that Putin told him he had to. We can't verify the truth of that, but it certainly is very convenient timing for Putin and for Russia. I mean, the reports are that the Vatican has been seeking this type of meeting for years now, and it's always been blocked at the Russian end. Now it moves forward. And it does seem like we're seeing at the same time a push from Russia to try and convince Europe to end its sanctions regime. And so it does seem like a good time for them to try and reach out now to the Vatican, to the Catholic Church, and see if they could get some help from the Catholic Church in persuading European powers to ease back on Russian sanctions and to start talking to Russia again.
Let's focus a little bit more on historically what happens when you see this kind of collusion between Germany in particular and Russia. You mentioned evidence of maybe even a backdoor deal, some kind of a deal just within the last few years that may have paved the way for Russia to make its moves in Georgia. Maybe you could talk a little bit of the evidence of that and then just give us more of that historical perspective on why we should be alarmed and concerned to see evidence of collusion happening today.
Been about 7 years, I think, since I was writing on the evidence of Russia and Germany coming to a deal over Georgia. But from memory, I think it was very interesting the way that it was a German change of course on Georgia's NATO membership that really stalled both Georgia and Ukraine joining NATO. And it was pretty much Germany that single-handedly stopped Georgia being put on the path to NATO membership. But I believe there was some kind of changing course from Germany with interesting timings that put a stop to that. And then if you look more recently at Ukraine, there are a few times over the past few years where Europe and Germany, if they really wanted to cause trouble for Russia and Ukraine, they could have done. And they could have done a lot more than what happened. They could have, for the sake of a few billion, which really to the European Union, to Germany is pocket change, they could have they could have kind of bought Ukraine at certain key points in this crisis. And they didn't do it. They didn't take those easy options. And I think that makes some interesting, raises some interesting questions. At the very least, are they not wanting to antagonize Russia?
So what can we expect if there's this kind of dealing going on between these two powers?
Right. Well, obviously, the big historical precedents would be the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, but shortly before World War II, where the two of them secretly agreed to divide up Eastern Europe, basically, between them. Beyond even beyond that, if you look at Germany, ever since Germany united under Bismarck, it has always had this strategic dilemma that it is vulnerable to being attacked from two directions, from both France and from Russia. And so if it wants to project power, it has to make sure that those two frontiers are secure. And so one way of doing that was in World War One, the Schlieffen Plan, that involved trying to punch France very quickly and then swing around and defend against Russia. World War Two, they tried coming to an agreement with Russia. Bismarck actually had a lot of interesting, I can't remember them off the top of my head, about, you know, the key to German power is a good deal with Russia, just to paraphrase. So they do see that to have the stability that they need to go on the offensive elsewhere in the world, they need that frontier with Russia secure.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's written an article called Why is the Pope Pro-Putin? You can find this article on thetrumpet.com. Richard, we really do appreciate you explaining this to us. There's a lot to process, a lot to think about, a lot to keep our eyes on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There's a lot of talk in America about the role of the Constitution, especially in the wake of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's recent death, a man who put a high value on the Constitution. But it is under attack in America today by a lot of people. This quote from Scalia back in 1997, he said, "I'm now something of a dodo bird among jurists and legal scholars. You can fire a cannon in the faculty lounge of any major law school in the country and not strike an originalist." So he was already, some years ago, had quite an antiquated view or an outmoded view of the Constitution. And as we've talked about, this attack on the founding document of the United States is very dangerous. It really should concern every American. This document was written by men who had escaped tyranny, who were well acquainted with the dangers of government having too much power, and they made a document that limited government, that prevented leaders from usurping control, that preserved the power of individuals and more localized government. I was reading an article in The Economist this week talking about Scalia. It said that he was in love with the Constitution. He was in awe of the men who wrote it. The late 18th century was a time when genius burst forth on the Eastern seaboard, as it had in Periclean Athens. But for him, the founding document was not living, as not some organism endlessly adaptable to society, as Justice William Brennan, a liberal predecessor, used to think. Its business was to block change, not to advance it. Now, this Economist article is kind of speaking tongue-in-cheek the way that it's describing Scalia's view, but Scalia said so many issues were never meant to be settled by an unelected committee of nine. They were meant to be resolved by the people through legislation. If he were a king, Scalia, that is, he would stretch the Constitution any way he wanted. In fact, as he admitted with a grin, it handcuffed him. And really, that's the purpose of the Constitution in a lot of ways. It is to prevent tyranny. Well, I wanted to alert you to a shocking attack on the Constitution. And this is really an extreme view, but I can't help but think that we should expect to see more of this kind of thinking. This is a statement by Black Lives Matter founder Alicia Garza. She's one of the three people who founded this movement And just Thursday evening during an event at Mizzou, she told Mizzou students, the University of Missouri, that the goal of the Constitution, this is a quote from campusreform.org, the goal of the Constitution was to make an agreement between factions known as states, which were built on the backs of black slaves. And a quote from her in this article, she said, "The people vowing to protect the Constitution are vowing to protect white supremacy and genocide." Now, I don't recall having seen this conflating of constitutionalism or defending the Constitution with racism. This is the document that has given more freedom to more people than any other government charter in history. It was a system that this document built that brought so many immigrants to America's shores, that has inspired so many people to attain great accomplishments and achievements in this country that they would have been denied under any other system of government, anywhere else in the world, any other time in history. But here are people who are saying that to uphold the Constitution, to protect this document, actually means protecting white supremacy and genocide. That is just a terrible, terrible lie. I have another article here written last September by Blake Simmons. That is a University of California, Berkeley student and a Black Lives Matter activist. And this is what this young man wrote. He said, "Our Black Lives Matter protests have stormed the country, yet cops continue to kill us daily, and the judicial system continues to justify our deaths with acquittals, non-indictments, and light sentences, all in the name of upholding the Constitution." Now, I'm not quite sure how the Constitution makes its way into this discussion. There is a battle going on between those who want law enforcement to remain on the local level the way the founders intended, and those who claim that local law enforcement is endemically racist, that the solution is to federalize law enforcement, that somehow federal police forces will be able to find a way to control those kinds of problems. Now, there's no evidence that that is true. It just really amounts to a pretense for a federal power grab. Maybe it's the Constitution's limits on federal authority that this student is criticizing. But notice what he says. "I have come to realize that the Constitution is the root of virtually all our problems in America. I've come to realize the Constitution is the root of virtually all our problems in America." That's an absolutely breathtaking statement that is almost 180 degrees opposite the truth. He says, "In order to understand the injustices against black folks in the United States, we must look back to its foundation. The U.S. is a country that was founded on slavery, genocide, rape, and white male patriarchy. The colonizers that we condemn for enslaving Africans and murdering indigenous peoples are the same people that produced and upheld the document we use to govern our nation to this day. Our bloodshed is rooted in this nation's founding document, the Constitution." And then he says, "A body cannot be separated from its head and remain living. The Constitution and all the evil that it allows to be perpetuated are the head of white America, or more so, corrupt America, racist America. If you separate the head, the racism will die." Now, where is this kind of thinking leading? I don't know how influential this young man is. I don't know how many people would agree with him, but when you listen to the attacks on the Constitution that are being perpetrated today, when you hear more and more deeply divisive and racist rhetoric being promoted by some of the highest leaders in this land, you have to wonder if the way that this young man is talking, if this isn't something that we're going to be hearing more and more of. Let me just read a couple more quotes from his article. "This Constitution was written for, quote, all men to be equal, unquote. Yet these same white men who cried out for equality and freedom from persecution owned black people as slaves and participated in calculated genocidal tactics against the black race. In addition, only white men wrote the Constitution. A Constitution written by only white men will never serve the interests of black people. The Constitution was written for the ruling class of white men, which constructed whiteness to be more valuable than any other race. When we discuss institutional racism, it is essential that we realize the Constitution created it. The reality is that it was the language in the Constitution that helped to undo the injustices caused by slavery. It was the language in the Constitution that Lincoln used to emancipate slaves and to free them and to make them full citizens of the United States, that all men are created equal. This idea that the Constitution is the source of all this institutionalized racism that we keep hearing so much about is a very, very destructive idea. The Constitution is to blame, he's saying. The Constitution, this charter of negative liberties that the president has talked about, that outlines how the government's powers should be limited so that individual liberty can flourish. He's saying that's the problem. And in this article, this student says America is not safe for black people. He actually quotes the Declaration of Independence. He says, whenever any form of government, this is the Declaration of Independence, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter it or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. He says, do we not have the right to abolish the laws that oppress us? It is time to claim the Declaration of Independence and apply it to our struggle as colonized black people in America. The United States has declared war against us. It is time we demand a new constitution or tell America that she will get the bullet. Now, that's some strong language here. Is this really the sort of thinking that's going to solve America's problems? I mean, I really hope that this is an extreme minority view. He says, it is our human right to overthrow a government that has been destructive to our people. This is why we must rise up and let all people come together and write a new constitution to serve all people. Well, what kind of constitution is he talking about here? He said, the idea for a new constitution is not a new idea, rather an old one that was developed by the Black Panther Party. In 1970, the Black Panther Party organized a revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention, however, after infiltration by the illegal COINTELPRO, the idea never came into fruition. We must pick up where the Black Panthers left off and declare a new constitution, or it will be the bullet. Well, do you want to live in an America with a constitution written by the Black Panther Party? I would rather stick with the one that we have. This says, if America truly wants to be a nation that values the lives of all people, it has one option, and the option is a national constitution convention. This is the last hope America has to become whole. If America fails to allow all people of this nation to write a new constitution, then it will be the bullet. Again, I truly hope that this is way far out on the fringe, that this Black Lives Matter activist, this UC Berkeley student, is viewed as a wacko by those who hear him. But looking at what is happening in the nation today, I fear that this actually gives us a glimpse into the kind of thinking that is pushing its way more and more into the mainstream of America. And to whatever degree it is acted upon, this nation will suffer for it.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Why are we so fat in the United States? About 2 out of 3 people are overweight, and about half of those are obese. This is a serious health issue. Obesity-related conditions are more than just a cosmetic problem. They seriously reduce quality of life and even length of life. They're actually some of the leading causes of preventable death. I have with me nutritionist Jörg Mardian to talk about some of the causes of this epidemic. And he's speaking via Skype from his office in Asuyus, British Columbia. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing great. So you, in your profession, you deal with people all the time who are struggling with excess weight. So I know that you've read a lot of literature on it, but you're also speaking from the experience of dealing with a lot of individuals and stories of people who are experiencing the health problems of being overweight and obese. Can you just talk about your experience with, say, what happens when an overweight individual, the kind of problems that they're experiencing, and then what happens when they lose the weight and how their life improves?
Right. So when typically when somebody comes to see me in my practice, there's usually a problem in their life, a medical problem, or they receive a scare, and that gets them into to see me, and then they say, "Look, I need to do something. My doctor said, or somebody told me, you know, in a profession that I really need to get my butt in gear, or I'm going to have serious problems," and so that seems to be one of the factors that drives people in here. Unfortunately, it's somewhat of a temporary factor. So when people come in, we usually set them up and we discuss why they want to do this. And I really do need to set that up with people, because we have to have a cause. It's like if somebody wants to stop smoking, if that person has no desire, I really can't talk to them and have any results. They have to have a desire to stop. And so it's the same with food. They have to have a desire to make a change in their life. And then we find out what that change is and where they want to go. Wanting to go somewhere is, with me, is not a short-term issue. I don't like talking about those because they don't work. That's where diets lead and all this nonsense with packaged foods that are low calorie. They simply don't work. And I've been in this for over a decade now, and I'm getting to the no-nonsense part where I just tell people, look, it's not going to work. Let's talk about the next 20, 30 years.
Okay, so some of the scares that you're talking about, the health issues that are obesity-related conditions, the doctor says, look, you got to do something about this now or you're going to suffer A, B, C, and D. What would some of those things be?
Well, obesity is a humongous problem right now. It's not just, we tend to look at it as a cosmetic problem, unfortunately, a lot, but there's actually a lot of studies right now that show that obesity is just as bad as smoking, and we'll get back to that again. There's a study in The Lancet, they had over 900,000 people, and they showed you can actually reduce your lifespan by 5 to 20 years with obesity alone. I mean, that is so shocking. And you're looking at a lot of factors. You can get heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and just a whole range of cancers. And most of these are just the leading causes of preventable death, and they are preventable. However, when we look at statistics in society today, we see about 8 out of 10 dying of disease, and those are preventable conditions, but they're prevalent because we can't get a hold of these problems. So when I do talk to people, I say, look, let's say you have type 2 diabetes. Let's say you have some of these factors that are giving you a scare. Can we help you in that? Can we get your body back to balance? Well, let's see what happens when we start eating good, when we start exercising and getting this problem under control.
Right,
so there's some big problems,
and the kind of results that you see. Say, it's one thing to say, well, you if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to be 5 to 20 years younger when you die. But even just here's the benefits that you can experience right now. You can have A, B, C, or D improvements in your day to day life. What would some of those things be? Just from your experience, what do you say? People say, "Wow, I'm really glad that I did this because this now my life is this."
Well, let's look at the pain factor. Every pound extra that hangs on your frame is 4 pounds extra on your knee joints. So if you're carrying around 60 extra pounds, that's 240 pounds on your knees. And a lot of people who are obese have knee problems, back problems, ankle problems. Let's talk about energy, getting up in the morning. How's your energy? You know, do you need 3 or 4 cups of coffee just to get going? Your body isn't firing on all cylinders. How about sickness? How long are we sick when you get a cold? Are you sick 2-3 weeks? That's not normal. And your immune system is shot. And, you know, and people come in and they say, look, I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm-hmm. And that's not a quality of life. It's all about quality. Can you get out there and walk with your kids? Or do you have to make an excuse and say, look, mom or dad's too tired. I can't. I really can't because I'm suffering. Family life suffers. Job suffers. Everything suffers. Quality is everything. It brings back that quality to your life.
All right. So let's talk about some of the causes. You mentioned this Lancet study. I don't know how much they got into the causes of this, but there are a lot of people, obviously, look at any infomercial on TV. There are a lot of people looking for a magic pill or a quick fix. But it seems like still when it comes down to it, the conventional wisdom is you lose weight by eating less and moving more. You got to watch your diet. You got to exercise. How true is that basic prescription?
It couldn't be more true. It really couldn't. When you look at the American diet, I mean, basically the saying is it's fatty, unbalanced, and oversized. And that really encapsulates everything. When we look at unhealthy food and excess of calories, that's a big, big problem. The research says that a lot of Americans pretty well only stop eating when they're sleeping. And I really had to think about that. And I said, is that true? But, you know, in the days of old, we used to snack and we'd snack on healthy foods. And that's okay because smaller meals are good for you. You shouldn't have to overeat at any one meal. So I really do graze all day, but I try to graze on healthy foods. But if you're grazing on junk foods, if you're constantly going out to a restaurant, I mean, you're going to be oversized. There's a study as well from the American Diet Dietetics Association that said 25 years ago, we used to take in about 1,850 calories each day. Now, since then, that's grown by 304 calories. It doesn't sound like a lot. That's about the equivalent of 2 cans of soda. It doesn't sound like a lot daily, but you have to think about adding this up. Theoretically, that's enough to add about 31 pounds to your frame at the end of the year. That's 1 year. Mm-hmm. You look at 2 years, and you're looking at a big, big problem.
And with a lot of people, it kind of sneaks up on you. You're not necessarily thinking about it too much. You get up into your 30s, your 40s, and by the time you're 50, you've got 50, 60 extra pounds. And you didn't really when did this happen?
Exactly. That's the thing about it. In general, people don't think about it too much. I mean, we have all the information available. You've got a humongous library on the internet. It's got some good information. But people, the thing that I always get is, I don't know how to put it together. I don't know who's right and who's wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, so people are a little overwhelmed. And there's several factors. It's not just food as well. It's exercise as well. And less than 20% of adults now meet federal guidelines for exercise. And exercise is a factor as well because it really stimulates the metabolism. And if you put those two together, it's a powerful weight loss formula. And you have to think also about the power of example. If less than 20% of adults exercise, what are their children doing? Are they copying the parents sitting on the couch? You know, it's all about example. And it's been proven that children will not lose weight unless the entire family is involved in the program.
And child obesity is a big problem as well.
Child obesity is a humongous problem. And they now say, and this shocked me, that children will they won't live as long as their parents today. And they say with a child, the obesity, it's harder on that child's frame, and they're going to die faster than the adults. And when they grow up now, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and we were talking about formula for children. And you're starting to get on formula with sugar in that first year.
Right.
And it just works up from there. And the parents don't really know, and they're not reading what's on the inside that package. And so by the time that child is 10 years old, I've literally dealt with children that had 30, 40% body fat at 10 years old.
That's not a good situation. Somebody has that at that point in life, then, you know, how much is their life disadvantaged from that point forward?
Well, you're looking at being pre-diabetic or diabetic at that point. By the time that a child is 10 and obese like that, and they don't get it under control fast, by the time they're a young person, they're diabetic. Once you're diabetic, I mean, people kind of look at that and say, there's so many diabetics, we can handle it. But no, the body starts breaking down pretty good. There's a host of problems with diabetes as well. And it is a disease. And people don't understand that each disease has a cycle. So we say in the industry, disease usually has a 10 to 20 year cycle from beginning to end. So we're all working on something in this society where we're just getting hit with chemical after chemical and bad fats and excess calories. So we have to pull out of that and bring the body back into balance. And I just don't see that with people today. They're just either from a lack of knowledge or being deceived by the industry, where they're fooling people and saying, look, this is really good food for you, but it's not. And it does sneak up on them. So in a couple of years, you can look at, I mean, shockingly, you can look between 30 to 60 pounds of weight gain in a couple of years. That used to take a lifetime.
Right. So one of the things that I appreciate about you, Jorg, is you're a plain spoken man. I'm sure that this is something that your clients appreciate as well. They come to you and they say, I need this, I need help with this or that. And you're telling them, look, the quick, easy solution isn't going to work. You've got to get real. We've got to look at reality. And you give them in plain language the prescription for what they need to do. You talk about the fact that this is, it's the lack of that kind of plain speaking that creates a lot of the problem to begin with.
Yes. Well, I find that there's a good amount of coddling in the industry. And we can say obesity does kill, just like smoking, but we hesitate to mention that fact because we think we're harming the individual by saying that rather than helping him. So we've become so politically correct that we turn a blind eye to this type of problem, and we avoid the fact that it's inactivity and poor diet. Those are the main factors in this problem. And any scientist will tell you today when they're going into these studies, look, we can get a hold of this. We really can, but we're not doing it because we're not really addressing it. The problem, bottom line is that we need more self-control. Yes, governments can interfere. They can get in legislation. They can get in better school programs. Of course, companies can start giving us better foods, and we can get more information for ourselves, but bottom line is no one puts that burger in anybody's mouth. And I tell that to my clients just like that. Say, look, at the bottom line, it's the buck stops with you. You have to make that decision to get better.
Right. It seems like people, they do want to point fingers elsewhere and blame soda companies or blame fast food restaurants or blame the government for not doing enough to regulate this or that. Or governments tend to really always think in terms of how can we solve the problem from the top down, and introducing regulations and increasing government oversight. But in the life of an individual, basically, you're saying you've got to take personal responsibility if you expect to make any decent change in your own life.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's common sense that if you're plate is groaning with burgers and fries and a couple of shakes on it, and you walking back to the family table at the restaurant and setting it down. I mean, it's common sense that that's not a healthy meal. It doesn't matter who you are. We've all heard that that type of food is not good for us. So, and then we're going to a restaurant 3 or 4 times a week. And I said to another client as well, I said, the evidence is right there in front of your eyes. If you're eating out a lot, and then you just need to look down at your waistline. If that waistline is expanding, there's your evidence. It's very plain. eating out and eating garbage food is what's doing it. So let's, and there are some ways that I tell people that they can, like you can keep a food journal, and that's very effective, and just to see what type of foods you're taking in. And it actually shocks people at times when they see how many times they eat out. And then just if you have a good week, just copy that week again. You know, if you've lost some weight during that week, repeat that week. That's where journals really come in. Mm-hmm. And but again, it's a matter of self-control. Journaling or looking at your foods or saying, look, I need to be there for my children in 10 years so I can play ball with them. That, those are issues of self-control. And self-control is just like a muscle. You have to exercise it. If you don't exercise it, you won't have it.
There would be some people who would be predisposed to put on weight more easily. But to basically resign yourself to that without taking that personal responsibility or using that as an excuse to absolve yourself of personal responsibility doesn't help anyone.
Absolutely. But that's less than 2%. Genetically, we know that it does exist, but even if, let's say, I'm genetically predisposed to gaining weight, if I eat very healthy foods, I'm going to negate a lot of that, because healthy foods, healthy wholesome foods, don't have a lot of calories and moderate control. So if you're eating and you're eating a moderate amount each meal and you're trying hard, I just don't see. I'll give you an example. I had a fella here that he lost 160 pounds in just over 1 year. And he was told he would die soon. And he came to me and he was in a panic. And he said, look, I've been large all my life. I've been told this is normal. I've been told it's genetic. Well, how did he lose that weight? He decided he wanted to be around for his children. He decided to listen. And we put him on a healthy diet and exercise. And he had some patience. And now the man went from a very large individual to one of a normal size. And his children now say that for the first time in their life, they can put their arms around his waist.
We've been talking with registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about obesity. He's written an article called Why Are We So Fat? You can watch for that in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jörg.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Some years ago, I spent a day at an elementary school as part of a program that invites students' fathers to be on campus throughout the day, serving as an extra pair of eyes, scoping the halls for potential threats, an extra set of hands helping in the classrooms. In 6 hours, I got an amazing education in human nature. I witnessed some pretty impressive things in some classrooms. One teacher in particular had her fourth graders breaking down sentences grammatically with jaw-dropping precision. In other classrooms, however, far less learning was going on. As teachers instructed, private conversations bubbled. Virtually any distraction derailed students from the task at hand. I believe I can distill the difference between the fruitful and the unfruitful classrooms down to a single factor: the teacher's determination to confront bad behavior. Put a bunch of kids together and you're bound to see some of that. It may start small, but if it isn't confronted and if necessary removed, it spreads. Just like the stomach virus that seems to wallop the entire elementary school every couple of months because parents ignore quarantine. It's true what the Bible says about a little leaven. A child talks while the teacher is instructing. If nothing happens, human nature whispers in the next kid's ear, huh, I guess it's okay to do that. So he talks too. Some other kid thinks, well, if he can do that, then I'll do this. In no time, the room sounds like Grand Central Station. Isn't that amazing? Sometimes I think children are hardwired to continue getting louder until someone tells them enough. The truth is, they're getting louder specifically to test how long it takes before someone tells them enough. The teacher with the intestinal fortitude to truly confront the problem can quickly transform the unruliness into ruliness. Dr. Albert Siegel once wrote, "When it comes to rearing children, every society is only 20 years away from barbarism. 20 years is all we have to accomplish the task of civilizing the infants who are born into our midst each year. These savages know nothing of our language, our culture, our religion, our values, our customs of interpersonal relations. The barbarian must be tamed if civilization is to survive." Now, that's a bit dramatic, but in a sense, it's true. Calling children savages certainly reflects reality better than treating them like natural-born saints. Our human nature represents a savage within each of us that must be civilized. Children have it in spades, unless we're diligent in confronting it. That's why Proverbs 29, verse 15 says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame." Where this reality truly smacked me in the face was on the playground at this elementary school. I spent three recesses outside with first graders, then second graders, then fifth graders. Each successive mob was worse behaved. The fifth graders, having lived more years without being properly civilized, were genuine specimens of savagery. Everywhere I turned, I saw carnality on parade, name-calling, accusing, cursing, screaming, boasting, pushing, sulking, cheating. I realized that most of these same kids had just been inside under the authority of effective, qualified teachers who had managed to keep a lid on this ugliness. The level of human nature suddenly on display correlated precisely with the lack of government in their lives at that moment. You take a good student out of the structure of a disciplined classroom and turn him loose with 60 other kids and virtually no supervision, and you have the Lord of the Flies. I hate to admit it, but the same is true in my own house, especially when my kids were younger. Those times when my family got overly busy and I didn't give my three children enough attention, things would get louder and uglier until it was too obvious to ignore, and my wife or I stepped in with a firm, "Enough!" That's not the way family should be. Yet it may not be exaggerating to say that this form of child rearing, ignore the barbarians until they drive you mad, is the number one method used in the Western world today. There's a lot to be said for maintaining a steady presence of civilizing forces in our children's lives. Activities, instruction, reading, games, chores, crafts, charts, schedules, rewards, punishments, supervision. Kids crave structure. When it isn't there, they act out until they get it. And when they do get it, it frees them up to achieve some amazing things. Now, don't get me wrong, family isn't boot camp. Doesn't necessarily take enormous effort to steer clear of pandemonium in favor of structured or even lightly supervised play. And it's not that children shouldn't be given enough room to make mistakes. We don't want to criticize them for every word or deed that just proves they're children. We need to make sure the overall message we send is a positive one. When we do things decently and in order, the way that God does, life is happier, more rewarding, more productive, more fun. As our children grow, the responsibility for structuring their lives and bridling themselves must gradually shift onto their own shoulders. They need practice at civilizing the savage within. Otherwise, the moment they're on their own, they'll turn into big versions of the fifth graders on that playground. And if you want to know what that looks like, visit an American university. The task of civilizing the infants born into our midst is crucial. 20 years is all we have. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like the analysis you hear on this program, then we want to give you a subscription to the Trumpet Magazine. The voices you hear on this show are the writers for this exceptional monthly news magazine. To receive the Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. We've also posted articles there daily, reporting and analyzing the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. When I look back on all these worries, I remember the story of the old man who said on his deathbed that he had had a lot of trouble in his life, most of which had never happened. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.